Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today I'm here with one of our sort of energy czars, I guess you could say. United States has got an energy problem. We don't know if we're running out of petroleum products. We don't know whether we're going to use solar energy in the near future or wind power or biodiesel. There must be someone that's thinking about this on a serious basis on our behalf in the United States government and the Department of Energy. And today we're talking to that very person. His name is Dr. Dan Arvizu. He's the chief executive of the United States Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory. That's up there in Golden, Colorado. So, Dan Arvizu, welcome to Science Studio, and we look forward to you telling us where we are these days.
Thank you, Keith. It's good to be with you today.
Okay, and before we get into actually what your job is, and obviously you've got a very clear vision of where we are and perhaps where we need to be, maybe not so clear on how we get there, but tell us a little bit about Dan Arvizu. How did you become an engineer and scientist?
Well, it's actually a pretty long story, but I'll try to shorten it. I was fortunate to grow up in a small New Mexico town not too far from here, Alamogordo, New Mexico. That particular town was blessed with the notion that the military base that was near it, Holloman Air Force Base, actually was able to, in some ways, subsidize the local school system. So I actually had some really good teachers and professionals that I got the opportunity to take advantage of. So from a very early age, they piqued my curiosity in science and in math. I excelled in those subjects from an early age. And as I got older and ready to start to think about what I might do, you know, the first thing you do is take inventory and you say, so what am I good at? What could I possibly do?
I can see all these little kids at night and say, well, let's take inventory today, right?
Yeah. So anyway, long story that kind of came to fruition was I had some excellent math teachers.
Right.
And as a result, they encouraged me, had tremendous mentoring all along the way. And one thing led to another. I actually had a music scholarship to New Mexico State.
Really?
Played the trumpet in the Aggie marching band. And went through starting an engineering curriculum because all my friends were doing engineering.
Right.
It turned out I was one of the few survivors. You know, out of all of us that started, there was only a couple of us that finished. And so engineering was kind of my the path that I started on. Still not quite sure what I was going to do when I got out.
You know, that's interesting because obviously here in El Paso we have a very large influx of Mexican American students, and engineering is always popular with people that have got relatively close roots to Mexico. I mean, the whole concept of ingeniero, the engineer, it's a very big deal compared to what it is, say, in England, which an engineer is, well, if you really got to do that, do it, but don't talk too much to the relatives, right? But here, this is it's a good tradition.
Yeah, well, it is. And I think, you know, it's cultural like that. Although, you know, I got to tell you, I was encouraged to seek advanced schooling. My father went to third grade. My mother barely finished high school. And they thought success was to make sure that I finished high school. That was kind of the goal. So my mother understood that an engineer wasn't just the person that drove the train.
Yeah, right.
It was actually a profession. And so it was a little bit of external forces that were actually providing me with more guidance and opportunity than
I mean, my wife's father was an engineer from here, from originally, well, Hispanic, Peña. But he was telling me when he went to school, not quite the same time, but there was a large influx of German engineers and scientists who were down here for the space program, for the rockets.
Right.
Wernher von Braun brought a lot of his people from Germany, or the United States brought them over here. And many of them landed up in the schools in El Paso. And was it similar there? You had some of the German residue, if you like, from the rocket age?
There were a lot of outsiders that threw essentially Alamogordo because they would be stationed at Holloman Air Force Base. So until the base built their own elementary schools, and they shared the junior high and high schools, but until the time that they began to have more of their own autonomous schooling, we had base kids, that we called them.
Yeah,
base
kids
are all a part of the deal. And they were very, very diverse, you know, different cultures, different backgrounds.
And they'd had a lot of experience in moving around.
And
there's a self-confidence to these military brats, I think they
very
refer
much
to themselves.
So. It gave me early exposure to many different cultures instead of being very insular. And I think that opened up our eyes. You know, people that had traveled the world and had experienced things that we hadn't even dreamed of yet.
Right.
So it was a good experience, I think. And New Mexico is very much dependent on federal resources. So something like 70% of their economy comes from the federal investment.
Right.
And so there was a lot of attention to things that were science and engineering related. And that, I'm sure, had an influence as well.
Did you ever go up to the Sunspot Observatory when you were a kid?
I did.
Up there in Cloudcroft?
I did. I was always fascinated by the stars and looking externally.
Yeah.
That
best place in the world, in fact. The Hale-Bopp Comet was first. Alan Hale was up in Cloudcroft and observed that the first time. Okay, then you went to Stanford for a higher degree in engineering?
That's correct. So as I caught some people's attention in my undergraduate curriculum, my department head came to me and started essentially giving me career counseling. That led to me taking a job with Bell Telephone Laboratories, and they sent me to school. So I had the opportunity to get an education at the school of my choice. At that time, I picked Stanford, of course, and I got my master's, later went back and got my PhD, same place, same type of program.
And now there you are, head of a national laboratory for renewable energy.
Yeah, who would have thought, right?
Well, but you wouldn't have, and that's the beauty.
Right,
I mean, growing up in London, I would never have dreamt of sitting out here in the sunny southwest of the United States. Mm-hmm. But here I am, and here you are.
That's right.
So let's talk about renewable energy. Give me the official line as head of this unit and the Department of Energy. What is the need for our renewable energy?
Renewable energy is a part of a solution to a very, very looming problem that we have. The problem is really that we don't have a sustainable energy economy or energy system. The difficulty with what we have today, which has served us well for more than 100 years, is that it's not sustainable in several respects. One is it depends heavily on fossil fuels that are becoming more difficult to both acquire and more expensive to get, and they're coming from parts of the world that are quite volatile. It has an unsustainable factor to it in that carbon emissions are now recognized to be a very significant problem for climate change, in that we're increasing the concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere, and that is warming the globe. And as a result of that, we need to do something fairly dramatic in our energy system primarily to reduce those carbon emissions. And then the last thing, of course, is just the volatility of the fuels that we use. They're mostly extractive industries. So that said, we don't have a sustainable system, and we've got to do something serious. The world's appetite for energy is getting greater, especially in developing countries. What we find is that unless we take some fairly serious, and I will call it corrective action, we're on a trajectory that is going to cause huge problems in the future. And we are now, at this point, moving that set of problems to our children and their children. And as a generation, I believe we have a very—
including the national debt.
Yeah, well, there's a variety of ways in which it manifests itself. But it's going to be very, very disruptive. Early action will minimize the long-term both damage and costs of changing what we do. So that's kind of the background and the setup. So what is it that, in fact, we can do? Well, what we can do is we can decarbonize the energy system. We can look at and transform our energy system in a way that allows us to use renewable resources, distributed resources, sustainable resources in a variety of ways, so that in the end, energy is still the primary ingredient for economic development and growth, and that is absolutely something that must continue, but it can't continue with the present system. It's got to be something very different. And therein lies the opportunity for renewables. Renewables and energy efficiency are the two things that my laboratory has as a focus in terms of a mission objective, and what we're trying to do is make sure that we adopt those technologies as rapidly as possible.
And as widely spread as possible, presumably.
And as
before we get into, what are the best candidates for renewable energy production, just describe a little bit about the concept for our audience and me too. Distributive resources.
Right.
What do you actually mean by distributive resources? This is just these big power lines we see and making them more efficient, or what do you mean?
Very different. Something very different. So the system we have now is characterized, and I'll just kind of try to paint you a picture. It's big power plants, big wires that connecting the power plants. And this is how it was developed, again, over 100 years. There really wasn't any central planning around it other than locally. But you end up, the characteristics are big generating stations, big wires that connect those generating stations, and then the consumer puts distribution networks kind of connecting to those big wires. And that system, by the way, is very inefficient. So if you just do the analysis, 60-something percent, 62, 65% of the energy content in our supply is wasted as losses and inefficiencies before it gets to the end point where actually the consumer uses the energy for some service they care about.
And that's losses through heat?
Conversion efficiencies, you know, when you have a turbine or a diesel generator or whatever, the conversion efficiency is like 30%.
Okay,
right? And so as you move that, and there's some losses in the wires, that typically isn't as big as some of these other losses. And then finally, you're operating an appliance in your home. Well, it's also relatively inefficient in terms of the energy in versus what service it's providing. So in order to do this problem, to solve the problem, I think, most effectively, you need to think about generation of energy near where you're actually using the resource. So that's the distributed nature of the concept. And just as an example, a building. A building uses all kinds of electricity. It uses electricity for lighting, primarily commercial buildings, heating and cooling and a variety of things like that. If you just were to build that building a lot more efficiently so that it didn't require as much heating and cooling and you did daylighting, you could reduce its consumption by two-thirds. Right? Then you wouldn't have to generate electricity somewhere else. You could actually generate electricity locally.
So in another way, what you're saying here is that this is part of what we would call perhaps conservation, you know, being more intelligent about how you design the tools, the houses, so that we don't need as much.
Yeah.
And that immediately gives us a great savings.
Yeah. I would broaden that conservation concept to say it's really the looking at the end use very differently. In other words, this is the transformation that needs to occur. The transformation that needs to occur is let's not look at the energy system as the thing we need to fix. Let's look at these services that it provides as the thing we need to fix. If we're looking for mobility and access on the transportation side, and if we're looking for power and comfort and heat for the electricity side, then what we really need to be thinking about is how do I provide lighting in a way that gives me the least requirement for generation of energy. And again, daylighting is one of those things which we don't typically use very well. I mean, we do sometimes in a home. But if you did that well, and in fact, I'll give you an example. We're building a building at the laboratory that I am fortunate to head today, which we'll move in the next couple of months. And that building will actually generate on an annual basis as much energy as it consumes. And it will house 800 people. Initially, it'll house 1,200 altogether when we're done. It's a major commercial building.
And what would the extra cost involved in producing that building as opposed to what you might call the traditional building?
And I'm glad you asked the question because I should then further add, and we built it for exactly the same cost as the building built to code.
Tell me why that hasn't caught on elsewhere. I mean, this campus, you're at the University of Texas at El Paso.
Right.
The state of Texas has been wonderful to us. You walk around and you see these Bhutanese buildings.
Right.
They look beautiful. They are beautiful. Mm-hmm. But they're all built on the traditional small windows, no daylight, no energy savings.
Right.
Is that part of the brief of your group?
It is
to sort of get out there and
Absolutely.
Say, look, public buildings at least, we should be doing this by mandate.
Yeah. As the laboratory whose responsibility is to kind of steward the government's investment in this, one of the things we need to do is have public awareness. Just let the public to know these things are possible today. This is not exotic technology. This is not futuristic stuff. This is possible today. And you ask the question, why hasn't this caught on? Why don't we do this? There are structural issues. The short answer is, we don't put the market signal, and this is kind of technology speak, but we don't put the market signal where the investment decision is. In other words, the builder builds a building at the least cost that the code allows. The tenant is stuck with the energy bills for the life of the building.
Right?
So there's a disconnect between those who's getting the benefits, the tenant, and those who are making the investment, the builder. The easy way to fix this, of course, is to change the codes. Make the code say, and the building must be efficient for its lifetime.
Right.
And we don't do that. Why don't we do that? Every jurisdiction down to the local community has their own set of rules about how you're going to build buildings.
Yeah.
That's a cultural, and I'd call it a market structure issue.
Right.
And this is not about technology. This is about we as a society don't value energy savings the way we should. And if we did, we could get past some of these what I call structural barriers and get us to a point where we could actually be very efficient and be very much more sustainable than we are today.
We're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Perhaps you suffer from rheumatoid arthritis, or your mother or an aunt does. The autoimmune disease, RA for short, affects 1.5 million Americans, and most of them are women.
Their immune system, which protects them from infections, also causes chronic inflammation that can damage organs, but especially flexible joints. Scientists have been looking for ways to block this response and recently found one.
Their work focused on a group of cells called macrophages. Macrophages are in every tissue in our body and are crucial to our immune response. Thus, they're also in the synovial fluid, which cushions our joints.
In people with RA, the macrophages in this lubricating fluid have elevated levels of a family of proteins called toll-like receptors, or TLRs. TLRs are critical in the early immune response by sensing invading pathogens in the body, but in RA, they end up targeting the joint itself.
In a previous study, blocking TLR signaling seemed to improve patient symptoms. In the new study, researchers also focused on TLRs, but this time on the molecules that process signals from the TLRs. This molecule is called IRE1-alpha.
Mice without this molecule had reduced inflammation and were protected from developing rheumatoid arthritis. Normal mice treated with the drug that inhibits this molecule also did not get RA.
These results show TLR signaling may indeed play a key role in this disease. If scientists can replicate the results in humans, would they be protected from RA, yet be more susceptible to infections?
Much is yet to be worked out, but if they could, the treatment would improve the lives of millions.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Dan Arvizu. He's the Director and Chief Executive of the United States Department of Energy National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. You're not just a research facility trying to find a better way to get biodiesel or improve silicon in order to get cheaper big crystals for solar power. You're actually thinking in terms of the philosophy of how to run an organization called the United States of America. Public awareness is a big part of your issue.
Yeah, you know, we've been frustrated for a lot of years. I mean, how long have we known about having an energy problem? I mean, I remember in the 1970s waiting in gas lines trying to get my car filled.
I remember in 1980s doing radio
and we
programs.
Did it again. We did it again. Yeah. So here we are like 30, 40 years later, and we've still got a problem. In fact, the problem hasn't gotten better. The problem's gotten worse.
All right.
So what we recognized at our laboratory is that there's a bigger issue here. It's not just about let's go do some really cool science. Let's go develop some really cool technologies and hope that something good's going to happen. That might have worked in other sectors. In the energy sector, it doesn't work. And it doesn't work for a variety of reasons, and we're getting smarter about that now. But what became obvious to me as the head of, again, the national program's investment in this arena was we have some fairly significant issues. One is the public really doesn't understand the complexity of the problem. The public doesn't really understand what we can and what we can't do. We hear a lot of things, but it's hard to get a credible voice out there that can sort through all the various interests and biases that people have when they make statements.
Well, one reason for that, of course, is the technology that we're so proud of constantly creating. Ten years ago, we were thinking, oh, natural gas. I remember El Paso Natural Gas Company, when it existed as such, had the first refrigerated tankers to bring natural gas from Algeria to Houston or somewhere.
Right.
Well, that died a natural death. Then they were going to start it again recently. But now they've got a whole new technology of horizontal drilling, so that natural gas reserves in the United States in the last 5 years have seemed to, and I can't put a number to it, quadrupled, quintupled, who knows what.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden people say, oh, we've got this just phenomenal reserve of natural gas, and that's the clean one, and therefore, hey, the pressure's off.
I think that precisely characterizes the difficulties that we faced over the past 40 years, because we think we're solving one piece of the problem while in fact ignoring other major pieces of the problem. So, you know, the three major challenges around an energy economy are, first of all, I think energy security, meaning ability to access energy at an affordable cost, right? The second one is environmental impact. And, you know, and we tend to think of environmental impact like acid rain, those kinds of things, where those are really very real problems. And we, to a large degree, I think, have mitigated those dramatically. But the next big issue, I think, has to do with carbon emissions, as I mentioned earlier. And then the third one is kind of economic. Energy is the engine that runs our economies. And even the developing countries want to have the benefits and the lifestyles that we enjoy in the West. And as a result, the appetite is going to increase dramatically. And there are, in fact, I think, access issues with it when it relates to fossil fuels in particular. Right. Now, there are a number of pathways. And the pathways, you know, there's nuclear, there's fossil fuels, and then there's efficiency and renewable energy as kind of the three major legs. We should not care. You know, this is kind of my philosophical pitch. We should not care which of those pathways actually get us to the endpoint that we desire. That's where we need to define the problem. The problem needs to be defined as the sustainable energy economy of the future needs to have certain attributes. And those attributes need to say it's affordable, it's accessible, it is secure, it's reliable, it doesn't pollute, it provides all of the benefits that we want. And we really shouldn't care which technology gets us there. If fossil fuel with carbon capture and sequestration can do the job, we should all applaud. That's a good thing.
Right.
If nuclear can do it, and solving, again, the safety, reliability, the nonproliferation, the waste issues, and they can do that, we shouldn't care. That should be part of the solution. Likewise, if it's renewable and we're very efficient, those kinds of things, those are all part of a mosaic that will ultimately provide you the attributes. But we shouldn't fool ourselves that, say, one technology, whether it's natural gas or another technology, what we should say is that those technologies need to be able to meet the criteria that we've established for the endpoint. And if they can, we should endorse and adopt that. What we find is that there's problems in all of those technology areas.
Right. I mean, CO2 sequestration, you know, seems to be something that, you know, you really would like to be able to do. And then, of course, the whole chemistry of transforming that CO2 into something useful.
Right.
That's a major area of research, I think, that young scientists should be going into, engineers and chemists and the whole business.
Just starting to scratch the surface
right,
on
exactly.
that one. I think we know we can capture carbon out of fossil fuels. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
You use half to a third of the energy
right.
just to capture it. And then you've got to sequester or put it someplace where it's not going to—
Until we know what to do with it.
Right. And those two pieces, I think, are a subject should be the subject of a lot of additional research going on.
So let's go to a few specifics about what you're doing in the laboratory. I mean, are you in the sequestration business?
The DOE National Laboratory, Department of Energy's National Laboratories, have very specific mission objectives.
Right.
The National Renewable Energy Laboratory, NREL for short, N-R-E-L,
right.
is the one laboratory within their system. There's like 17 laboratories that is dedicated for the purpose of moving renewable energy and energy efficiency technologies into the marketplace.
Okay.
So that's my mission as the director of that laboratory and steward of this investment that the government makes. That's what I'm about, is trying to do that. Now, there's another laboratory for nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
There's another laboratory for fossil fuels.
Okay.
And they work primarily on carbon capture and sequestration. That's
okay.
the National Energy Technology Lab in Pittsburgh and Morgantown.
So you would be into wind energy, biodiesel, solar, and things of that nature.
So that's correct. So
so
we're looking, again, at the renewable piece and the efficiency piece.
All right.
Those who would advocate that, you know, we can do it all. I mean, every laboratory that has a mission all believe that at some point they can do perhaps most of the problem. We all report in to an undersecretary of energy at the Department of Energy. And this is Dr. Christina Johnson. She's just a fabulous researcher, brilliant scientist, quite an entrepreneur just in and of herself. She has the daunting task of making sure that all of these pathways and the electricity grid and all are working in a collaborative fashion to solve the national problem. We've got some place where we integrate all these various pathways, and we all are kind of on the same strategic plan for getting to the endpoint.
Let's go to everybody's favorite long-term solution, at least it's mine. And since every erg or watt of energy or whatever it is that we have basically originates from the solar system, from our sun.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's about time that we got big crystalline panels on all houses to use directly. Is that really, going to happen in the next 10, 15, 20 years from your perspective? I mean, you're on the ball here. Right. You know better than most.
Right. So we have
been a long time coming.
It has. You know, look, the photovoltaic effect, which is the direct conversion of sunlight to electricity, was discovered in 1865. Okay,
right.
by Edmund Becquerel, I think. It was not until, you know, a century later that Bell Labs demonstrated the first solar cell. It's going to be a while. Now, I can tell you this. Photovoltaic technology is moving really rapidly. And what scares me is that the U.S. is not going to lead. We have been the intellectual horsepower behind these mm-hmm. technologies. But I can tell you right now, having traveled the world, is that China has 6 of the top 10 photovoltaic manufacturers in the world now.
Right.
And they're making huge investments. So the technology will move, and it's going to move very quickly. How long will it take? I like you, I'm a solar guy, and there's more solar resource than all the other renewable resources combined. And one of the things that we've recognized is that mid-century and beyond, it's going to be all about solar. I'm convinced of that. But it's going to take time. And there's going to be lots of research. There's some phenomenal things going on at the nanoscale right now where we're actually going to be able to paint photovoltaic materials onto surfaces and make fabrics out of them. I mean, there's some just exciting science. But it's going to take time. And that's not going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years, maybe not even next 20 years. But who knows, 40 or 50 years from now, I'm on the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, and we're looking at what is the mitigation potential for climate change of renewable energy. And I can tell you, and this is a world effort, as you might know. There's thousands of scientists that are part of this. I'm the coordinating lead author for the solar chapter. And our chapter will say that there is, in fact, tremendous potential for solar energy to provide a large fraction of our energy needs. In the U.S., if we say 10% or 20%, you're almost, you know, thrown out of the room because people don't believe that you can do that. If you're in Europe, they're saying 50% is their business as usual, and their stretch goal is 100%. So
there are people over there in Europe that think solar energy is going to be 100%. They don't live in England, I bet.
Well, they're
they don't see the sun that much.
That renewable energy is going to be 100%.
Okay, renewable in
including
general.
Including wind and geothermal and biomass and a variety of other things.
Right.
Solar will be a large fraction of that. And in fact, there's all kinds of projects that say, let's take the energy in Africa and move it north to Europe.
Oh, it's the same as taking the water from Canada and moving it south.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that. So anyway, there's a lot of discussion about that. There's a lot of really good opportunities going forward, I think.
Dan, we've come to the end, and we haven't even really scratched the surface of what you do. I think I'm going to come up and visit.
You should.
You know, and
you
go
should.
To all the different people, and because there's stuff that people need to know.
Right.
And as scientists, we're very sort of reticent, and engineers, to sort of proselytize and tell people in simple terms and in an engaging conversation what's going on. So you do well, and I'd like to thank you so much for being here on Science Studio, and look forward to seeing you again many times, actually.
Well, I would welcome people to come to our website, nrel.gov, and you'll find a wealth of information regarding all types of renewable energy and some of the exciting things we're doing at the National Renewable
Energy. That's great. Well, thank you very much on behalf of the nation for the job you're doing for us. I hope you're successful.
Thank you, Keith. I appreciate it.
And thank Norma Martinez for editing the program. I think we can also thank the Camille and Henry Dreyfus Fund for helping put some of these things together. And, of course, lastly, we thank you for listening, because if you weren't listening, why would we do it? But we'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Nomi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The anesthesia residency program at Texas Tech's Paul L. Foster School of Medicine will close on Monday. The closing comes after University Medical Center dropped its $11.2 million anesthesiology services contract with the school. According to media reports, loss of the contract will cost Texas Tech about $18 million this year alone. Read more at mcasynapse.org.